Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this Courthouse Steps oral argument on Federal Communications Commission versus Consumers Research. Speaking with us today, we're joined by Professor Chad Squitieri of Catholic University of America Columbus School of Law. And moderating the discussion, we have Adam Griffin, who is a separation of powers attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we may turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers and not the Federalist Society. And with that, Adam, thanks for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thanks, Edie, and thank you to the Federalist Society and to everyone for being here today. We're here today for a Courthouse Steps oral argument teleform to discuss Federal Communications Commission, FCC, versus Consumers Research. In this case, the FCC authorized Congress to regulate interstate and international communications, and as part of that, to maintain a universal service fund that requires telecommunications carriers to contribute quarterly based on their revenues. In order to calculate these contribution amounts, the FCC contracts with the help of the Universal Service Administration company. Within this structure, the constitutionality of these delegations of power to the FCC by Congress and to the USAC by the FCC are now being challenged in court by Consumers Research. Here to discuss this today is our expert, Chad Squitieri, an assistant professor of law at Catholic University of America's Columbus School of Law. There, he serves as the director of the Separation of Powers Institute and as a managing director of the Center for the Constitution and the Catholic Intellectual Tradition. Professor Squitieri's scholarship addresses administrative law and constitutional law topics, including separation of powers principles. His scholarship has appeared in the Administrative Law Review, the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy, and the Baylor Law Review, among other publications. Prior to joining the faculty at Catholic University of America, Professor Squitieri practiced law at Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher LLP as a member of the Appellate and Constitutional Law and Administrative Law and Regulatory Practice Groups. He also served as a special assistant to former United States Secretary of Labor Eugene Scalia and as a law clerk to then Chief Judge D. Brooks Smith of the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. Professor Squitieri, thank you for being here today to discuss this important case, and the floor is yours.
Great. Well, thanks very much to Edith and FedSoc for having me. And thanks, Adam, for that introduction. You and I have known each other from various conferences and things, so it's great to see you again. Let me start by with two disclaimers. So first, I'm speaking today only my personal capacity. And second, I just want to note that one of the lawyers who represented the challengers in this case is an adjunct professor at my law school and is affiliated with an institute that I run at the law school, but the lawyer did not bring that case in his capacity with the law school or the institute, just in his private capacity. But I wanted to just flag that. Anyway, so I understand that part of my role is to provide an overview of the case and argument. So I will start with that overview and then flag five things that I found interesting from the argument. And it was a lengthy argument. It was about 2.5 hours. So the upshot, I think, of the argument is that regardless of how this case comes out, the argument, I think, was a step in the right direction for reinvigorating the non-delegation doctrine. And that is great news for those who think, like I do, that the non-delegation principle is a fundamental aspect of our Constitution. So let's dive in. The case concerns money that essentially cell phone consumers have to pay on their cell phone bills to pay for something, pay into something called a universal service fund. So in essence, the universal service funds help subsidize telecommunications services and places like rural areas and educational facilities. And back in the day, these types of services could be paid for by regulating the rates of telephone monopolies, requiring monopolies to maybe charge below cost in rural areas where it was expensive to provide service and above cost in more urban areas to kind of even things out. But when the government broke up the telecom monopolies, there had to be a new way to pay for this universal service fund, and thus to pay for universal service. And thus the universal service fund, which is made up by contributions paid for by the telecommunication companies. But of course, the telecommunication companies do not pay those USF fees themselves. Instead, they are permitted, and they do pass those USF costs on to you, the American consumer. So in short, telephone consumers essentially pay a special tax on their phone bills, or perhaps a fee. In an argument, there were some debates about whether it was a tax or a fee, but regardless of what it is, it's money coming out of the consumer's pocket to pay for universal service. So paying for something like universal service might be a good idea. And perhaps if Congress did it itself, it would be a good idea. But Congress does not set up directly the fees that the consumers are charged, or divvy up the money, or things like that. Instead, Congress has empowered the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, to do that on Congress's behalf. And to make things more complicated, the FCC has itself delegated responsibility to a private entity called the Universal Service Administration Company, or USAC. Right, so USAC is a private company. It has a 20-member board of directors comprising of individuals from various interest groups affected by and interested in the universal service programs. So USAC is tasked with helping to figure out how much money is needed to pay for this universal service. Again, a private company. The statute does not impose any direct monetary limit. The statute does not say, you know, here's the max amount of tax or fee that you can raise from the consumers. Each quarter, USAC issues proposals for how much money to raise. And then those proposals are deemed approved if the FCC essentially does nothing. They just remain passive. And after, I think it's 14 days, then the private company's proposal is deemed, that's how much Americans are going to be paying for this telecommunications tax. And there was evidence in the record suggesting that the FCC essentially just rubber stamped these. I think it was four times the FCC had ever kind of corrected the private company's recommendation. Twice, I think, were after this litigation had started. And at least one of those, there was something like the USAC had a number that went out to like four decimal places, but the FCC's computer software could only go to three decimal places. So they just like rounded it. So not a lot of involvement by the FCC. So to kind of summarize this rather complicated regulatory structure, and I think it's important that it's complicated for the taxation power, because it leaves American consumers saying, who in the world is imposing this tax on me? But to summarize this, the goal is to essentially subsidize some telecommunication services and offer what's called universal service. Congress tasked the FCC with doing that, and the FCC then turned around and tasked USAC to help figure out how much to tax or to collect in fees from the American consumer. So this case as a legal issue concerned those delegations, whether one of those delegations or perhaps a combination of those delegations was unconstitutional as a violation of the Constitution's non-delegation principle. So the non-delegation doctrine places limits on Congress's ability to delegate its powers to other entities. And typically we're talking about administrative agencies as the entities receiving that power. And at the moment, for those lawyers that might remember from common law, the judge-made test for enforcing the non-delegation doctrine asks whether Congress has provided an agency with a, quote, intelligible principle. If yes, if Congress did cabin that discretion with a intelligible principle, then the delegation is constitutional, it's permitted. If not, then not. The Fifth Circuit focused its non-delegation analysis correctly, in my view, by noting on a particular power, the Congress's Article I taxation power. The idea being that this cost on the American phone bill is a tax. And the Fifth Circuit suggested that Congress is delegating that taxation power to the FCC might violate the non-delegation doctrine, right? The Fifth Circuit said Congress giving power, taxation power to the FCC, that might violate the non-delegation doctrine. I think there's quite a bit to this argument. As Congress Congress empowered, for example, the FCC to define on like an evolving basis what universal service even is. So the FCC might change its definition of universal service, and that would, of course, change how much money we need to raise for that universal service. So you can see how the FCC gave the, you can see how Congress gave the FCC quite a bit of leash to determine both like what are we paying for, and therefore how much do we need to pay for that. So that's kind of a flavor of the problem of the delegation from Congress to the FCC. But in addition to pointing out that problem, the Fifth Circuit suggested that, well, the FCC's further delegation to that private USAC entity, that might, again, might violate the private non-delegation doctrine. The gist here being that by empowering the private USAC to figure out how much money to raise, the FCC had unconstitutionally delegated power to private entities. But again, the Fifth Circuit did not go so far as to hold that delegation to the FCC or from the FCC to USAC. The Fifth Circuit didn't rule that independently those were unconstitutional. Instead, the Fifth Circuit offered a more limited holding, which said that the combination of those two delegations from Congress to the FCC and from the FCC to the private entity, that combination was a constitutional violation. And in coming to that combination conclusion, the Fifth Circuit noted, you know, some of the other aspects of the statutory regime, which the Fifth Circuit felt important, presumably because they showed there was limited political control over the delegation here. These other statutory contexts included an argument that the FCC was purportedly insulated from presidential removal, and the argument that the Universal Service Program funds itself outside of the political control offered by the standard congressional appropriations process. So this case, it was the en banc Fifth Circuit, by the way, who had ruled this. This case went up to the Supreme Court, and it was argued yesterday at the Supreme Court. And the argument focused in large part on the two independent delegations from Congress to the FCC and from FCC to USAC, not as much attention provided to the particular combination theory that was really the central holding of the Fifth Circuit. So that's an overview of the case. And with kind of the remaining of my opening remarks here, I want to flag five things that I found interesting in the argument. Again, it was a long one. First, I thought that regardless of how this specific case comes out, this was a good day for the non-delegation doctrine. And that's because all three parties at argument, so that's Consumer Research, who had brought the non-delegation challenge, and then the government, and then an organization called the Competitive Carriers Association, those two were defending the statute. All three of them agreed that the Constitution's non-delegation principle limited Congress's authority to delegate power. Right. That's important because law professor Cass Sunstein, for example, once quipped that the non-delegation doctrine only had one good year and nearly 200 bad ones. His point being that the Supreme Court is said to have only invoked the doctrine to hold laws unconstitutional on non-delegation grounds, that the Supreme Court only did that in 1 year, 1935, but in no other year. And so building on top of that argument, or consistent with it, some have argued that perhaps the non-delegation doctrine shouldn't exist, or that perhaps the non-delegation doctrine is really just a laugh line, or that it might not be judicially enforceable. So I found it quite relevant here that even the parties defending the statute agreed that no, the Constitution does have a non-delegation principle. It's just not violated here, they argued. And even more notable, I didn't hear any justice suggesting, at least not loudly, suggesting otherwise. Right. Everyone kind of appeared to assume that, yes, the non-delegation principle is an important part of our constitutional order. So that's point one I found interesting. Point two that I found interesting, the court and the parties paid a lot of attention to the differences between congressional powers. And I think this is a step in the right direction toward reinvigorating the non-delegation doctrine, because I think it aligns with what the court should do when it hopefully reinvigorates the non-delegation doctrine. So building off of my past academic work, I filed an amicus brief in this case, arguing that the Constitution's non-delegation principle should apply differently to different congressional powers. And here, I just want to flag the good work of the law firm Weil, Gotshal & Manges, and in particular, my friend Luke Sullivan, a lawyer there, who did some great work filing that brief on my behalf. I think we should have power-specific non-delegation doctrines rather than a single one-size-fits-all doctrine, because the Constitution does not vest the legislative power at all in Congress. It does not do that. The Constitution instead vests particular powers in Congress, like the power to tax or the power to regulate commerce, coin money, so on. The Constitution also vests in Congress the power to make all laws, which shall be a necessary and proper means of carrying Congress's enumerated powers into execution. So in my academic work and in that amicus brief, I argued that an original understanding of Congress's different powers might allow Congress to delegate different powers differently. For example, a necessary and proper means of carrying out the taxation power might permit Congress to exercise some sort of delegation, but a necessary and proper means of carrying out, say, the power to establish tribunals, that might permit only a different level of delegation. So I think that's how the court should think about the non-delegation principle going forward, and for at least several reasons. For one, it's more consistent with the Constitution's text. Again, the Constitution does not vest the legislative power. So to focus on that power in the abstract, it's inconsistent with the Constitution's text. Secondly, adopting several smaller tests can also lead to more judicially manageable standards for the non-delegation principle. Identifying in the abstract the fundamental difference between the legislative power and the executive power or the judicial power, that can be difficult. And it's arguably easier and more judicially manageable to focus on specific words in the Constitution and to take the non-delegation questions in bite-sized pieces, focusing on those specific words. A third benefit of my approach was that it would lower the stakes some for non-delegation challenges, because a non-delegation holding concerning, say, the taxation power need not affect Congress's ability to delegate other powers like the commerce power. So there was a lot of talk at oral argument about whether the universal service charges were taxes and thus a product of the taxation power, or fees and thus a product of the commerce power. And the defending parties argued, well, it didn't really matter because the same non-delegation doctrine test should apply regardless. And I disagree with that. And the challengers to the statute seem to take a strategic position to highlight that the court has in the non-delegation context treated some different powers differently in the non-delegation contest, and thus didn't ask explicitly to overrule the existing non-delegation standard. But I nonetheless thought it was notable and a step in the right direction that the parties and the justices were spending time analyzing the potential significance of Congress having different enumerated powers. In the future, I think the court should indeed, perhaps in this case, because there is flexibility in the case law, perhaps you might get an interesting concurrence or something like that. I think the court should say going forward, we're going to consider non-delegation more consistently with the Constitution text, which means power by power. That's the second important thing I thought in the argument. The third thing I found of interest in the argument is that neither the parties nor the justices showed much interest in the Fifth Circuit's unique combination holding. And to be frank, I can see why that is, because respectfully, the Fifth Circuit was not super clear in explaining why, if one of the two delegations was not itself problematic, or if they were both okay by themselves, then why automatically did the combination of that result in a constitutional error? And that's because I think the Fifth Circuit is bound by something like the intelligible principle test, which doesn't make obvious why that combination would result in an independent violation of the Constitution. But I would just note that under the test I propose, which would run through the necessary and proper clause, ask, is this particular statute a necessary and proper means of delegating this particular power? Well, then the combination theory does start to make sense, right? Two things can be fine totally on their own, but not when combined together, right? Like toothpaste and orange juice, fine on their own, but when you bring them together, right, not fine, right? And I think courts, if they are going to adopt something like combination theory, should perhaps run that through the Constitution sex, the necessary and proper clause. And that gives you a overarching framework to consider the issue. So on that point, I think the Fifth Circuit was right and its gut was in the right spot. I would just quibble with some of the words. The fourth thing I found interesting, I didn't hear a single mention in the argument of the potential mootness questions in this case. And I might have missed it, but I didn't hear certainly much time spent at all on the potential mootness problem. When this is significant because when the court accepted this argument for case, the court sua sponte added a question concerning whether this case was moot. And therefore, they can't reach the merits. The theory being, as I understand it, that because the challengers only challenged a contribution factor from 2022, I believe it was, and that had already been paid, and because the court might not be able to afford monetary relief for payments already made, that perhaps this case is moot. The parties agreed that no, this case was not moot, and that sounds right to me. In part because of the capable of repetition yet evading review doctrine. There's not enough time between when a contribution is proposed and when the money's going to be paid to kind of fully challenge and litigate this. This issue is bound to repeat. There had been some talk I heard that the court maybe added the mootness question as a possible way of kicking this case and not reaching the underlying non-delegation merits. And I suppose that's still possible, but nobody seemed interested in taking that path, that argument. Fifth and finally was a kind of interesting point the Solicitor General made unrelated to non-delegation doctrine. In particular, this dealt with the president's removal power. She signaled correctly, in my view, that the FCC commissioners can indeed be removed by the president. And in the past, it had been argued that the relevant FCC statute purported to limit the president from removing the FCC commissioners from office. But the SG noted that that's not actually in the statute. So those are my opening remarks, and I look forward to any questions that we might have.
Thanks, Chad. Great presentation. I'm going to start with a question. And then if you have any questions, please place those questions in the Q&A. There's a Q&A feature. There should be a Q&A feature on your screen. If you have any questions, we have one question in the queue. Please feel free to put any questions in the Q&A or chat, and we're happy to get to them. So I thought I read your amicus brief, and I thought that the idea of focusing on it's not the legislative power, it's all legislative power. So when we're looking at non-delegation, we need to look at what is the specific enumerated power that the delegation is operating under, and have they delegated that power, or is the law that they passed consistent with the delegation of that power to Congress in the first instance? But I was wondering, did you consider at all, and I think this came up a little bit in the oral argument, that maybe it's not even a tax, it's like actually a commercial regulation? I think that came up a little bit with Sarah Harris, and that this was actually more of a rate regulation, a commercial regulation.
So great question, and correct.
Would that change the analysis?
Yeah, so I think it would. I think it would change analysis. I don't know enough that would change the outcome, but it would change the analysis in that. So in my brief, I briefly note that, you know, the government, and like, I think it was two paragraphs, suggested that, by the way, this could be an exercise of the commerce power and not the taxation power. And I essentially said that, okay, if the government is, that seems like they have more or less given up on that argument because they haven't really spent a lot of time on it. And I suggested the court should ask an oral argument, are you still defending it on those grounds? And if they are defending on those grounds, I think the court should ask for additional briefing and argument, saying, okay, well, how is it defensible on those Commerce Clause grounds? At argument, the SG continued very briefly to defend it on the Commerce Clause grounds. She also, I thought, this was in her reply brief, I believe, she made an interesting point, and I think I agree with this, that she said, look, if Congress doesn't usually say explicitly which power it's using, and perhaps out of a constitutional avoidance principle, the court should analyze it under both potential powers, right? The taxation power and the commerce power. And if it can survive either of them, then it survives. And I think that sounds right. She kind of criticized an approach that said, If it can be done under taxation and commerce, and it fails under taxation but survives under commerce, well, then it fails because it fails under taxation. She's like, no, that's not the right way to do things. And I think I would agree with her on that. But yeah, that's where even though, you know, the government's position is that it doesn't really matter because the same non-delegation test should apply. I disagree with that part, but I liked how we're moving in the right direction of saying, look, there are different powers here. I would just go that step further and say, and there are different tests.
And maybe Congress should speak clearly about what power it's exercising.
Yeah, precisely. You know, can I have a comment on that?
Sure.
One thing that came up a lot in the argument was, because you're totally right, if Congress was clear that this was a tax, I think the American people would take note. And there were some suggestions at argument saying, well, because there's no numerical limit on the tax here. And some of the justices were thinking through that and said, what difference would it matter if we just required Congress to do a numerical limit? If we required Congress to say, by the way, FCC, you can go up to $5 trillion. They're like, that seems kind of empty. My response is, no, it would matter quite a bit, because if your congressman said, by the way, I just passed a $5 trillion tax hike, I think that would get your attention. But if your Congress says, by the way, I told the FCC to go do good and nice things, and if they raise too much money, you should blame them, not me, that's totally different. So I think requiring Congress to kind of be clear when it's taxing the American people and be clear about how much that tax is, I think it does have a significant value. So I appreciate you raising that.
That's a great point. I mean, if Congress sets the value and you can point to a number, then the American people are going to look at the amount that they can be charged. If there's no limit, then they say, oh, universal service. That sounds great. Exactly. Do you think a cap would have made it constitutional?
You know, the challengers' exact position was that it needs to have some sort of objective limit, whether that is a numerical cap or some other like not wishy-washy aspirational, we can redefine what universal service means limit. And that sounds right to me. Justice Thomas seemed interested in that. Mm-hmm. Justice Kavanaugh seemed a little interested in that. They asked questions along the lines of like, have we ever approved of a tax that doesn't have a limit on it? And so I think adding a limit, whether it's exactly a numerical cap, I don't know if it has to be that, but adding some sort of objective limit does sound right to me. Because, you know, if you just kind of think how normal people talk and you say Congress passed a tax yesterday, you might say, well, how much? And then the answer is, oh, we don't know. It's impossible to know. It will change in the future, depending on a definition that an agency can just change on evolving standards. It's like, okay, well, then Congress didn't really pass a tax, right? They've done something else. So I think we need to kind of hold Congress rightly, hold their feet to the fire and say, if you think this is a good tax, okay, be explicit about it and go defend it. Don't kind of kick the can.
Okay. Our first question in the queue, and we just have one question right now. So if anybody has any questions, please use the Q&A function. Frank Garrison asks, and it's kind of a two-part question. First, let's address this first. Does the private non-delegation doctrine have anything to say here? Like, the private non-delegation doctrine was kind of brushed aside. There wasn't much discussion of it. Do we think that there's only one non-delegation doctrine, or is it the same inquiry, whether it's applied to the executive branch or to a private party? Does it change that at all?
So under kind of existing framework, they are different. And the government kind of really tried to compartmentalize those points, saying, you know, the first delegation is your standard non-delegation test. The private non-delegation is really kind of a matter of like executive power analysis. Under my theory, it would all be part of the same thing. The question would say, when Congress enacted Section 254, is that a necessary and proper means of carrying the taxation power into execution? And you would dig into it and say, well, what did it do? Well, is it necessary and proper to both delegate to FCC the authority to further delegate to a private entity, right? The constitutional error comes with what Congress permitted in the statute. So under my theory, the private non-delegation doctrine would not be a standalone violation, but it would be pulled into the broader question of, did Congress have the constitutional authority to enact this statute? That's under existing case law, it is a kind of a separate analysis. But I don't think it needs to be.
So, but it could still, but whether the party is public or private could change the outcome. I mean, so you could say, is it necessary and proper to carry into execution the taxing power to create this delegatory scheme under USF? But it might be necessary and proper for the government to exercise this power, but it may not be necessary and proper for a private entity, right? Sure. I mean, the outcome could change based on the public-private party, depending on the nature of the fact-specific context.
Absolutely, right? And I would want to look, and maybe some powers, historically, Congress relied on private actors, and some powers, like a taxation, you would think not. So I totally agree that it could change on that. And as a reminder here, this private entity is like interested in how much money is coming in. Right. So one of the examples I think the challengers make in their brief, it's like, what if we asked a defense contractor, Congress says, this is how much money we're raising for military defense. However much this company that sells defense stuff to the United States, however much they decide, and they'll give us a number. And if no one does anything for 14 days, that number will be correct. I think intuitively we realize that that can't be correct. Why is it correct here? So I totally agree that there are features of private interested individuals when they're the ones making decisions that can change the constitutionality of it.
The second part of Frank's question is how does your different delegations for different powers? So your theory is that that we should consider which power, and the non-delegation doctrine could be different depending on the nature of the power, relate to Gary Lawson's view of the fiduciary constitution and the sub-delegation doctrine he describes under it. Are you familiar with Professor Lawson's
theory? Yeah, I am a little familiar with it. And Professor Lawson and I have talked a little bit about this, and I think that my theory does not require adopting his fiduciary analysis, but it can embrace it. And I haven't come down totally on whether it should and indeed embrace it. But I mean, Professor Lawson is obviously a leader in this field, and so when he says something, I'm inclined to think he's correct, and then dig into it and try to determine that myself. But my theory is more of a structural theory that says, here's how we're looking at the powers, and then once you get in there, you can use different approaches. So you could definitely use the agency theory, relying on background principles of agency law that Professor Lawson recommends. You could, if you wanted, I don't think we should, but you could do like an intelligible principle test for each power, right? What's an intelligible means of telling someone how to tax as compared to coin money? That could be distinct. I don't think you should do that. But I'm offering basically a structural framework based in the Constitution's text. And then within that, I think there are debates to be had about how to go more narrow. And again, Gary Lawson has been thinking about this for decades. And I think given the rich historical background of fiduciary and agency law, that seems like he's onto something there to me.
Right. And I mean, you could think about it, shifting the non-delegation doctrine to focus on the powers may actually kind of bring the fiduciary constitution idea into play a bit more, in the sense that each power is a delegation from the sovereign people, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, people delegate all power to, because the people are sovereign, not parliament under our system. All power that's delegated to the legislature is a delegation from the people. Therefore, any time that the Congress delegates a power to the executive or to a private entity, they're kind of sub-delegating a delegation from the people. And so that may strengthen the non-delegation doctrine. I think in your amicus, you like briefly made mention of, as faithful agents of the sovereign people's constitution, federal courts are not permitted to look the other way when the constitutional lines are crossed. They must call foul when Congress violates the Constitution's non-delegation principle. And one of the things you said, I had not read this article, but Substantive Canons and Faithful Agency by Justice Barrett. I don't know if that article has any relevance to like whether agency principles should come into a proper originalist understanding of the non-delegation doctrine.
I don't recall. It's a fantastic article. I recommend your listeners to go check it out. Justice Barrett wrote it when she was a law professor before she was demoted to being a Supreme Court justice, right? Being a law professor is the best job in the world. Terrific article. I don't think it totally maps onto this precise thing we're talking about. It's more like how a textualist can embrace substantive canons. There might be some relationship there. But nonetheless, it's a great article that I think people should check out. But your point about the kind of the sovereign American sovereignty, I think, is spot on. Congress is not sovereign, right? They cannot enact whatever laws they want to be. They cannot enact whatever laws they think are necessary and proper. It says those laws shall be necessary and proper. And courts, of course, courts are not sovereign either, but they're also an agent of the American sovereign, we the people. And we have told courts exercise judicial power. And if Congress is going beyond the powers that we gave them, you need to do something and not give effect to that law within the bounds of an Article III court. So I think looking at the kind of fundamental principles of sovereignty in America and how it's different from in England, I think you're exactly correct that that's very relevant.
So we have another question in the queue. Can you talk a bit about one, non-delegation and congressional authority to insulate executive officials from removal or a private entity? And two, can you tie the congressional authority to the current fight over the removal power? Do you see the do you have the Q&A function? It might help to be able to look at the question.
Let me open that on your screen. Oh, yep. I can open it up here now.
Okay. So the anonymous attendee, it's, can you talk a bit about non-delegation and congressional authority to insulate executive officials from removal or a private entity? And can you tie the congressional authority to the current fight of the removal power? And so I'm wondering if there's something about non-delegation and the power of Congress to insulate insulate agency heads from removal.
So I think they are relevant, at least under my theory, my necessary and proper theory, as follows, because you could just say, okay, is it necessary and proper for Congress to delegate a particular power to an executive official to do X? That's question one. Now, is it necessary and proper for Congress to delegate the power to the executive official? And by the way, that executive official can never be fired by anybody. That, I think, would be quite relevant to determining whether the second statute is necessary and proper. And you can imagine why the first statute could be necessary and proper. Yeah, sure, Congress needs to delegate authority to executive officials, but not, no, Congress, when it delegates authority to executive officials, those officials can't be insulated from removal. But I think that can change the nature. So this is where I might push back slightly on some of the defenders of the statute at argument, where they try to compartmentalize the delegation and the removal. And I would respond, no, you have to think through, who are you delegating power to? Right? We've already talked about, if you're delegating power to like a private entity, that might change the analysis. If you're delegating power to an executive official, but it turns out that executive official is like not really purporting to be in the executive branch because they're purporting to be like outranking the president of the United States, right? I think is relevant or necessary proper clause analysis as well. So we, like in school, it's good to learn them separately. And we often argue and debate them separately, but they can be connected in situations like this. The Constitution's like a wonderfully interconnected document. And sometimes these things overlap and play with each other.
One interesting point that Clement mentioned in passing is, if this is an exercise of the taxing power, then it would be like appropriations, right? I mean, it's money raising.
His point there was, I think he was saying, look, if you guys say this is a taxation power, then I forget the particular clause of the limitation on taxation power, that the revenue raising has to start in the House.
Right. And this started.
Yeah. And I think he said this one might have started with the Senate. And the implication there might be being like, so don't call it a taxation power. But my response is, well, if it is an exercise of the taxation power, then it's like doubly wrong now.
Right.
I get his point. Maybe as a matter of constitutional avoidance, you might say, okay, since this could be a Commerce Clause authority, we're going to presume it to be, to avoid an additional constitutional avoidance issue. That might be what he was getting at, and that sounds sensible to me. But yeah, he's, the point being, there are particular limitations, not so much delegation limitations, but particular limitations on, like, you know, what's a direct tax or revenue raising has to start with the House.
Right. What's interesting is, you know, if they said it was a tax, or even if they don't say it was a tax, if could there be a challenge to this scheme under the origination clause and saying this is it, whether they say it's a tax or not, we think this is a tax. We think this is an appropriate or a money raising taxation issue. This had to originate in the House. It originated in the Senate. It's unconstitutional for that reason.
Yeah, I think that it totally could tee up a challenge like that. I'm reminded a little bit of there was an old challenge to SORNA, which was the statute involved in Gundy, a big non-delegation case of recent years, which I know Adam knows about. I remember one of like, I think in the lower courts, one of the courts said the agency has a good cause because it's not clear what the attorney general like needs to do. So he needs to act quickly to tell the world, like, what's he going to do? And I suspect that an entrepreneurial lawyer realized and said, what do you mean the statute doesn't tell the attorney general what to do? That sounds like a non-delegation challenge. And that perhaps, I'm assuming, might have led to the eventual non-delegation challenge to that statute, which, you know, it ended up the majority kind of read the statute in a way that avoided the non-delegation challenge, but it resulted in, you know, the now famous Gorsuch concurrent or dissent. And here we are. So yes, I think when a court says X and issuing its holding, it might flag potential constitutional errors for future cases.
All right. I have one more question. If anybody else, we've been through the two questions in the queue. If anybody else has a question, please tee it up for us. Last question that I had was, this kind of goes to Justice Kagan's questions, is why does the text not provide sufficient limiting principles, right? Like the text said, there was stuff about, you know, substantial majority of residential customers, reasonable and affordable rates for like the health, safety, welfare of the people and the customers. And they went back and forth a little bit about, oh, the text, there's so many words in the text that maybe it seems more constraining, or there's so many words in the text, maybe it seems too amorphous. It kind of reminds me of Scalia's like easy ragu recipe thing. Everything's in there if you have, you know, a bunch of words. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering why weren't there sufficient limits in the text? Can you go through some of the textual exegesis and explain what the text means and why or why not there were sufficient limitations in the actual statutory text?
Yeah. So for me, the big problem that the challengers really hammered on is that it's a tax to do what? To provide for universal service. What is universal service? The FCC can redefine that on an evolving basis, right? So there were limitations saying like, you know, it needs to be sufficient to like pay for universal service. Okay, that sounds like a limitation, but when you can redefine what universal service is, then you can also essentially redefine what sufficiency means. And I think this really came through in one of Justice Kagan's hypotheticals with the challenger, where she said, you know, if I order, it was a very funny example. She said, if I order pizza sufficient for 10 people, and then an 18 wheeler shows up at my house with all these pizza, you could like hear Justice Thomas laughing in the background. She's like, that is not what I meant. And most people would understand that. And then the challenger, McCotter, responds and says, well, you said sufficient for 10 people. And here we're saying sufficient for universal service. And universal service can be redefined by the FCC itself. So the limitations are like missed, right? They kind of look like limitations, but the FCC can get around this. And interestingly enough, I think for 25, 30 years, the FCC had essentially said, by the way, we don't have to listen to these various principles. Justice Kagan suggested, well, that sounds unreasonable, which is kind of interesting because we're just coming off of the Chevron world, where presumably the, you know, FCC was the expert about what the statute means. And if they said it for 30 years, presumably those experts would have been correct. But now she was willing to say that, no, those 30 years, they actually didn't know what they were talking about, I guess, or they were unreasonable. But again, the point being that lots of words, but not really providing a limitation on the FCC itself.
So We have another question in the queue. I know that Justice Gorsuch asked a question about the use of open statutory language like appropriate and reasonable. SCOTUS is considering the Wages and White Lion case concerning FDA's interpretation of what's appropriate for the protection of public health. And I wonder how these two cases will interplay. So do you see any interplay between Wages and White, Wages and White Lion case concerning FDA's interpretation of what's appropriate for the protection of public health and the current case?
Yeah. So I'm not familiar with the case asked in the question, so I can't speak to with too much authority on the topic. But I would say one probably potential significance is how much authority does the FDA have to redefine the meaning of public health? Because if it in universal service, the FCC has the authority to redefine universal service. So they can say we can raise as much money as is sufficient to do X. And by the way, we can define what X means. I would hope that the FDA does not have similar authority to redefine the meaning of public health. But if it does, it would be susceptible to the same challenge, I think.
And then another question, what are your predictions on Justice Barrett following Justice Scalia in saying that non-delegation is, a political question or there's no judicially manageable standard for the non-delegation doctrine?
Yeah, so I'm not the best at counting noses on the Supreme Court, counting votes. And Justice Barrett was particularly hard for me to read, I think. So I don't know, but I will say that there was a lot of talk at argument with other justices and litigants about the non-delegation doctrine indeed being judicially manageable. So I thought that was a good thing and a step in the right direction. I don't know if where Justice Barrett will come down on that precise question. I'll note though that the person who has inherited the Scalia seat, Justice Gorsuch, he kind of he essentially said that the line you kind of quoted earlier, Adam, I think I was quoting Gorsuch, where he talks about, courts can't turn the other way when constitutional lines are crossed. And he was essentially speaking to Justice Scalia, who said, the non-delegation doctrine might be a very, very important part of our constitutional order, but not often one that courts can enforce. And Gorsuch disagrees with that. I hope Barrett goes with Gorsuch on that route. I don't know. I can't predict precisely, of course.
I think that's all the questions we have. I think it's a really interesting case. And of course, the non-delegation, the separation of the legislative and the executive power and what the right framework for analyzing the non-delegation doctrine is a very complicated and difficult question in constitutional law. And so we really appreciate your expertise today and helping us dissect this case and helping us to think through how we should analyze the non-delegation doctrine going forward. Do you have any final remarks?
No, I would just say thanks very much for having me. I know you and PLF in general are doing great work on separation powers, and I really appreciate FedSoc for holding these sort of hearings and discussions to help get the conversation going. So I'm just appreciative of both of you for having me.
Yeah, and just to echo that, on behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Professor Squitieri for speaking with us today and to Adam for moderating. We really are grateful for your time and expertise. And thank you also to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.